Yeah, thank you. Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I am Dick Beeman. I'll be your convener today. And I want to extend a special welcome to newcomers and visitors. If you are a visitor, you might wonder what Unitarian Universalism is all about. We are a welcoming congregation. We adhere to the seven principles that are indicated on the back of your program. Unitarian Universalists tend to be comfortable with uncertainty and uncomfortable with dogma. Unitarian Universalists tend to believe that humankind belongs to the earth, not the other way around. We tend to believe in exercising the human intellect, nurturing the human spirit, pursuing social justice, showing reverence to the independent web of existence, and fostering and promoting artistic expression. I encourage all visitors to sign the guest book in the lobby and to indicate if you would like to receive the newsletter. And visitors are at this time very welcome to sit quietly in anonymity if they wish. But if they wish to be introduced or introduce themselves, now is the time to raise your hand or introduce a friend. Okay, you're welcome to sit in anonymity. Oh, here we have one.
Well, I will introduce my friend, Linda Broderson from Clay Center. She's been here before, but she likes us well enough to come about once a month.
Thank you.
I should actually introduce my partner, Jane Powell, who's here for the first time with us. Yeah, but you're going to stand up anyway.
The announcements are indicated in your order of service. Please have a look at those. There are several important things coming up. I want to mention one in particular. The final meeting of the Path to Membership group will meet with John Liu in the ALSOP and Ina's ALSOP room at 12:15 today. And now Gene will light the chalice. Thank you, Gene. Today's program is all about language and the meanings and connotations of words. So let today's chalice flame put us in mind of the power of words, either for good or for ill, just as the flame can either illuminate or incinerate. Words can wound, discourage, confuse, or alienate, but they can also console, heal, enlighten, or inspire. Please stand now as you are able and sing our opening hymn, number 38, Morning Has Broken.
I invite the children to come on up for a story. And there's Spider-Man. Yeah, you can have a seat. You, yes. Yeah. So the story that I have this morning is a true story, and it's a story that happened in India. Do you know what kinds of religion there might be in India? No? Do you all know? What religion might you find in India? Hindu. You might find Hindus. You might find Muslims. Okay. So I think we're going to find some Hindus, some Muslims, some Buddhists maybe, and some Christians. Isn't that interesting? So the story happens in the early part of the 20th century, a long time ago for you all, when there was a man named Gandhi who was working for independence of India from England. Just as we fought for independence from England, so did India a long time later. So Gandhi was working for independence, but he was also wanting the people to learn how to read and write. And there was a Unitarian minister who came from England, and her name was Margaret Barr. And she came from England because she was inspired by Gandhi. His ideas about people working together inspired her. So she came to India to help him. And when she first met him, he said to her, he gave her some advice. He said, keep out of jail and find something constructive to do. And so she went around looking for something constructive to do. And she had a translator with her. And as they were wandering around, a stone hit her on the leg. And she looked and she realized that there were a whole group of children, a whole bunch of them, who were fighting. They were throwing stones and they were yelling at each other. And she asked her translator, what is this? And the translator said, well, they're calling each other stupid and dirty and all kinds of names like that. And she says, well, why would they do that? She says, because they're all different religions. Some of these are Muslim children, and some are Hindu children, and some are Christian children. And they're all fighting amongst each other because of that. Well, Margaret didn't think that seemed right at all. And so she decided, well, she asked, well, why would they do that? Where would they learn this kind of hate? And the translator said, they learn it in their schools. Because the Hindu children go to Hindu schools, and the Muslim children go to Muslim schools, and the Christian children go to Christian schools. And Margaret said, well, this isn't good. This has to stop. So she decided to start a school where all the children could come, and that they would all learn about each other's religions. So the Muslim children would learn about Buddha's enlightenment, and the Christian children would learn about Muhammad receiving the Quran. And the Hindus' children would learn about Muhammad. They'd all learn about one another's religions. And she started a school. She started an orphanage in the Khasi Hills, where there were already some Unitarians. And she taught love as well as reading and writing. And she felt like one of the things that all the children needed to learn was to treat one another kindly, no matter what religion they were. And every time she returned, all the people greeted her really enthusiastically. They said, Kubhai Kongba, giving her great honor among her people. And so whenever she got discouraged, she'd remember those crowds of children that she had first seen. And she said, if I can teach one child love and compassion, that child can teach one family. And if I can teach, and the child can teach one family, then the family will teach one village. And if one family can teach a village, then that village can teach an entire nation. And eventually we will end hatred in the world. So that's our story for this morning, and you all can go to your classes.
Oh, in love, our hearts go with you. Oh, in joy, our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light. wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Are there joys and sorrows to share?
My name is Susan Gormley, and I'm Ellen's mother, and I have no news to give you yet, but she is in the hospital, so today's the day.
Others? We are mindful that there are joys and sorrows that may be unspoken. Oh, one more.
I just want to mention the heaviness of my heart at another mass shooting in the school. I think that's one of those things that we want to acknowledge when we're gathered together, that those things are going on in our world and they affect us even though we're far away.
Okay, I'm Linda Broderson, and on this Wednesday, I'm flying to Ohio to visit my son and his family, and actually, I'm going there to play with my grandchildren. I may say hi to the older people, too.
Thank you. Can we stand now as you are able and sing hymn 112, Do You Hear?
Thank you.
the power of words. The language of God is silence. Everything else is just poor translation. Not everything even has a proper word to describe it. And it's hard to notice a thing for which the tongue has no description. The limits of my language define the limits of my world. So the words we do have are sacred. Treat them with care and respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little or craft a poem that will inspire a stranger. The right words, manipulated deftly, can capture you. They can wind themselves around your limbs like spider silk, enthrall you, pierce your skin, enter your blood, intoxicate your thoughts, work their magic inside your brain. Shakespeare wrote that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, but I'm not so sure. I think a rose might be diminished if it were called a skunk cabbage. If possible, please try to avoid words that are too big for the subject. Don't say inevitable when you mean probable. Don't say millions when you mean several. Awesome when you mean pleasant. Otherwise, you will have no word left when you want to talk about something truly awesome. And I now turn over the podium to the truly awesome Reverend John Lee Johnstone.
I don't know if I'm going to live up to that. Well, thanks, Dick, for that brilliant introduction, but more for that contextualization about the power of language. We have to acknowledge that if we want to talk about what is deepest, most valuable, most awesome, our tools are limited. Silence might be best. But humans that we are, we seem driven to share our experience. Art provides one method of communicating, or perhaps I should say several methods. But we also long for the more direct, descriptive modes of sharing that require less interpretation. The tools we have are the inadequate ones of symbols. And the symbols we use most readily are words. And when we want words that are hefty enough to represent what is most profound, they are often religious or spiritual words. And let me add a specific Unitarian Universalist contextualization. In 2003, then president of the UUA, Bill Sinkford, stirred up a hornet's nest with a sermon in Fort Worth, Texas, that was called The Language of Faith. A local newspaper misquoted him as arguing for the addition of the word God to the principles and purposes. That's not what he said, he insisted. Rather, he wanted UUs to reclaim a vocabulary of reverence. And for many people, that was bad enough. Interestingly, he was borrowing an idea and a phrase from a staunch humanist, a professor at the Meadville-Lombard Theological School, the UU Seminary in Chicago, David Bumbaugh. David had written and spoken about finding a humanist vocabulary of reverence. And let me share a brief excerpt of his statement. We, and by we he means specifically humanists, have dismissed traditional religion as an atavistic aberration. We've given up the hope of a constructive dialogue. We have manned the ramparts of reason and are prepared to defend the citadel of the mind against a renewal of superstition until the very end. But in the process of defending, we've lost the vocabulary of reverence, the ability to speak of what is sacred, holy, of ultimate importance to us, the language which would allow us to enter once more into critical dialogue with the rest of the religious community. If this be so, then the recovery of a vital vocabulary of reverence is a task of great urgency for those of us who cherish the humanism tradition. So that was what David Bumbaugh had to say about it. Now, Bill Sinkford and David Bumbaugh would not choose the same words for a vocabulary of reverence. For one, no one would ever accuse David of wanting to add God to the purpose and principles. But both leaders argue for including religious language within Unitarian Universalism, in part so we can speak among ourselves, but also so that we can speak to the larger culture and dialogue with other religious people, so we can be part of the conversation. Somebody actually produced a book out of this whole thing, A Language of Reverence, essays by some Unitarian Universalists addressing the topic that I've found useful and interesting. So why do we want to dialogue with other religious people? Many of us, particularly atheists, agnostics, and humanists, have felt excluded and dismissed by other religious people, particularly by evangelical Christians. And we can't forget the truth of that exclusivity and that feeling of being excluded. However, we do share some goals with other people who come to their social justice work through religious pathways. And the most effective way to do that work is together. For example, we UUs have been leaders in environmentalism, but we're not the only faith group doing that. The Pope's statement on climate change and even evangelicals' growing concern for stewardship of the earth demonstrates a willingness to address an issue dear to our UU hearts. And there are other issues we can collaborate on with people of other faith traditions: peace and justice work, anti-racism work, respect for religious diversity. Even with some progressive Christians, Buddhists, and Jews, reproductive health and rights for people without regard for sexual orientation or gender identity. And what I've learned in working across faith orientations is that sometimes people will use their religious language. And that if we're going to be able to work together, I have to at least be able to tolerate their expressions of faith. And I have to be able to explain how my own faith tradition of Unitarian Universalism relates to my work and maybe even to their religious language. And there's a deeper reason for dealing with religious language that relates not to our external work, but to our being a community together. If our congregation is to be a safe haven, then people need to feel safe enough to share their full selves without defensiveness. Because like it or not, we're not a club for atheists. We are a religious community that proclaims no creedal test. That means that atheists, agnostics, theists, Buddhists, pagans, existentialists, and Christians somehow need to bring their full selves here and talk about their experience and do it without making it an unsafe place for people who disagree with them. This requires some finesse in how we talk together. Each of us has to be able to name our personal experience without the assumption that other people share that experience. And at times, we do need to name our communal experience, and in that case, we need to be sure that others agree with that naming or at least can go along with it. So we have to be careful not to confuse those two kinds of talking together. We have to be clear when we're speaking collectively and then be careful to use language that includes all of us. And when we are speaking as an individual, then we may use language that does not include everyone because we're sharing a personal belief, experience, or practice. And at the same time, in listening, we need to accept other people's personal beliefs, experiences, practice, and language, even when it differs from our own. And this is a delicate balance. UUs take language seriously. I've been part of two UU startup congregations that struggled over what to call themselves. The James Reeb UU Church was chartered in Madison, Wisconsin in 1993. Within a couple years, we were holding meetings to discuss changing the name. Pagan and Jewish members of the group were uncomfortable with the name church. We had open, vulnerable conversations about the word and what it meant, and ultimately decided to change the name to congregation, since it was more inclusive. People supportive of the word church accommodated, learned from the experience of others, and determined to be more intentionally inclusive. On the other hand, the church I most recently served in Oklahoma City was the first Unitarian church and had been for more than 100 years. And there, in the overwhelmingly evangelical context of Oklahoma City, far different from Madison, Wisconsin, they found some mainstream legitimacy by having the name church. And I heard that even from members who were pagan and Jewish. Different contexts demanded different use of language. And then there are the Bull Run Unitarian Universalists. They were a group founded in the early 1980s, and as a charter member, I was part of the discussion about names there. People didn't want to be a church for many of the same reasons that were brought up at Reeb. And though they led, they didn't want to be a fellowship because some members found that word sexist. They chose to be simply BRU, Bull Run Unitarian Universalists. No church, no fellowship, no congregation. That's who they are to this day, BRU. Hard conversations about our shared identity is part of our work together as a congregation. We have to be sensitive to what language triggers for one another, but also to how it's meaningful for one another. To start with, we have to understand that we don't always mean the same thing, even when we use the same word. That's because we come with different sets of experiences and expectations. Even when people define their identity with the same word, atheist, for instance, they don't always mean the same thing. Sometimes we simply have to ask, with curiosity, not with judgment, what do you mean when you say X? Unlike a congregation that defines itself with a set of beliefs, we don't always have to share our religious language. Prayer may be powerful for some you use, while others have long resisted the cultural imperative of prayer and find it distasteful and even oppressive, though it was not mentioned to me as a religious word that we love to hate, interestingly. But we don't want to tell non-praying UUs that they must pray or tell praying UUs that they must not pray. Religious and spiritual words relate not to some external identifiable reality that we can see and agree on, but to our internal experience, which is subjective and personal. To me, prayer is well-wishing, sending energy, hoping good things, not begging for favors from a daddy God. A prayerful attitude is humbly connecting with the universal energies, for me. Religious language is highly metaphorical, rich with imagery, and not best interpreted concretely. Religious words have many shades and shadows, ambiguities, and associations. One could argue that that's a good reason to leave the words alone. Simply don't use words like meditation or worship, covenant or benediction. But because the words have many associations and point to many personal experiences of value to the individuals who have them, that course of setting aside religious language leaves some people feeling they have to leave behind a piece of themselves, which is not desirable. In Unitarian Universalist congregations, we acknowledge that no one of us has a corner on the truth. So we have to help one another come closer to the truth, grow spiritually by sharing our ideas, which may contradict one another. How do you mix together pagans and Christians and atheists and Buddhists and find common ground? You can only do it with the understanding that coming together, we learn from one another, that each of us is teacher to the other, that each of us can speak the truth as she or he knows it, and no one of us believes that's the end of it. We also have to be able to say to one another, that's an interesting idea. Here's how I see it, without accusing them of being wrong. That's a challenge, especially when the beliefs that we utter are deeply and strongly held. I would encourage what I'd call a radical agnosticism. That is a basic acceptance that none of us knows with certainty any of the fundamentals related to religious or spiritual life. While that stance could risk being dismissive of faith statements, it could also allow us to hold our own certainties a little more lightly. To quote the British religion writer Karen Armstrong about Socrates' approach to philosophy, "To philosophize was not to bludgeon your opponent into accepting your point of view, but to do battle with yourself." She goes on to describe how contemporary discussions of what we believe are often aggressive. Perhaps like that of Young Meno, a well-recognized debater, in Socrates' interchange in that book, looking at Meno, Plato quotes Socrates as challenging that debating style, instead encouraging a manner more gentle and more proper to discussion for friends who want to discuss with each other. In other words, we strive to approach such conversation with curiosity rather than judgment, suspending disbelief, holding our own worldview lightly, exchanging with a friend whom we value, and see where it leads. So I'll make an overgeneralization about religious language. Particular words, even words we find prickly and abhorrent, exist and continue to be used because someone has found them useful and valuable. We may disagree, seeing them as hurtful or meaningless, but if we are interacting with someone in the attitude that Socrates offers us, we might hold our own assumptions lightly as we proceed. Another way of looking at it comes from Michael Dowd, a UCC minister and environmental activist, and Connie Barlow, his UU scientist atheist wife, who talk about two different ways of describing the world that both have value, but that have different purposes. They talk about day and night language. Day language is concrete and verifiable, precise, descriptive, and striving for accuracy, the language of science. Night language, on the other hand, is mystical, mythical, metaphorical, the description of experience, what something feels like rather than what it actually is. Night language is symbolic, pointing toward truths that cannot be fully discerned or adequately described. Both night and day language give us meaning, but in different ways. In speaking of religious language, retired UU minister Laurel Hallman suggests that we need to break open these concretized words. So we've taken words that are night language and tried to use them as day language, seeing them as more specific than they are. So we need to break open those concretized words, to juxtapose them with words that create cognitive dissonance. For it's in the spaces between the juxtapositions that new associations are created. An example that she gives is calling God she, which challenges the concretized image of a father God. Laurel reminds us that we're talking about the products of imagination here. We're pointing, not positing. In other words, we're using night language. So with that, let's talk about some specific words and some categories of words. First, religious and faith. Interestingly, I find both these words in the concluding paragraph that sums up the UU principles and sources. It says, "Grateful for the religious pluralism which enriches and ennobles our faith, we are inspired to deepen our understanding and expand our vision." So, according to that document, we have religious pluralism rather than a singular religion. And that enriches and ennobles our faith. So the question remains, are we a religious people? If we delve further into the bylaws of the UUA, I know that's something we all do on a regular basis, we find that member congregations have only a few requirements, and one of them is that they conduct regular religious services. At least they didn't say worship. Worship, at least according, I heard from one person, is unthinking obedience and subservience to an all-powerful person or God. But that's not exactly how the dictionary sees it. It doesn't claim that worship needs to be unthinking or obedience. Rather, the etymology frames the word in terms of worth and honor. The definitions include terms like honor and respect. And to me, UU worship is a process of discerning and acknowledging what is worthy of respect and honor. If so, perhaps the services we conduct are religious, tying us to what is most worthy. Religion, if we explore the etymology, comes from Latin religare, to tie fast. I've heard it explained as that which ties us together. There are, of course, multiple meanings and connotations, an institutionalized system of beliefs and worship, practices of a group, a cause, principle, or activity pursued with zeal or devotion. But I think the definition that creates the problem for folks is belief in a supernatural power. For many people, that definition holds more weight than the others. And that makes it problematic for people who do not define their beliefs in relation to a God. Yet not all religions define themselves in relation to a God. Buddhism, for example, certainly doesn't. And I think there's another dimension to it. I hear practices and words described sometimes as too religious. And often it sounds to me like it really means too Christian. Because I don't ever hear you say that words from other traditions like mindfulness or non-attachment or even meditation seem too religious. It feels like there's more tolerance for religious language from non-Christian traditions than there is from the words identified with Christianity. And that's not surprising, because Christianity is the predominant religion in this country, the religious tradition many of us have rejected, and the religious tradition that sometimes seems to squeeze out those of us who don't adhere to its tenets. UUs have often felt wounded by Christianity and react to that with defensiveness. Faith is a complicated word. Because in part it can substitute for the word religion, Jewish faith, Hindu faith, or it can carry different connotations. For example, in the phrase have faith, faith can mean a deep abiding trust and has often been seen as unreasoning trust, blind faith. And I think that's what we UUs struggle with. One quality we share is that we hold everything open to questioning. Unlike a cult. Cult is a word similar to faith and religion, having a legitimate academic meaning of a religious sect. But it also has evolved to have negative connotation. I had a phone call once from a woman who wanted to know if we UUs were a cult. I told her that as far as I could tell, we were the opposite of a cult. Because in a cult, the members follow the leader without thinking, and in UUism, no leader goes unquestioned. And that's the way we like it. In fact, people submitted to me as words they love to hate a number of words that seem to imply a kind of blind faith, unswerving loyalty to a singular viewpoint that leaves little room for other ideas. God's will, God's word, damnation. Someone also offered mission, explaining that he saw mission as a single-minded focus on changing others, evangelism taken to an extreme. And indeed, when we look at what happened on this continent as Native Americans were dragged into missions, cut off from their own cultures and converted through threat, mistreatment, and even torture, mission holds a lot of negative connotations. Yet mission also holds the power of focus and purpose, and used in that framework may be useful. God's will. It's often spoken as a way of asserting that a particular thing should or must happen. And for many of us, the idea that any human creature dares claim to understand the will of God can only be hubris. And when that's applied in situations where someone is hurting or grieving, as when someone they love has died and someone says it's God's will, it seems outright obscene to claim that an enigmatic deity has somehow willed death to happen. But I've suggested we hold these difficult words with curiosity. What does someone gain by seeing God's will written in the events of their own life? It could bring reassurance. It could help them feel connected with something larger than themselves. It could even be a way of accepting a reality that's hard to swallow. We all struggle with realities we don't want to accept. If we can find a way to say, I don't like what happened, but it happened, and I accept the reality of it, even while I'd like to wish it away. Some people might be saying that when they say God's will. Is there a way we can engage them to say, maybe simply, it's not helpful for me to think of it that way? And if we dare to add, can you help me understand what you mean by God's will? I don't know. That could be a conversation that none of us is ready to have. But it would disrupt the assumption that we all believe the same, which is part of the challenge that we UUs face. We can feel like we're disappearing because our beliefs are assumed not to exist. And the only way to help others know they exist is to share them, though not defensively, as a weapon. Similarly, God's word implies an understanding of the Bible that we may not share, that some books were given directly as revelations by a divine source while others were written by people, and that we can draw some kind of clear, distinct line between those two. Damnation implies a similar distinction between saved and unsaved. Fear of God may at one time have been a way of inviting awe, but has generally been co-opted into literal fear related to damnation. Salvation is the value that Jim Chanteau reminded me that UUs consistently rank last. It can be difficult for us to understand this division into saved and damned, especially when we figure others put us into that damned category. And repent, too, comes up in these conversations because it's an admonition to change in order to move from damned to saved, as does sin, which gets us into that unsaved category. However, if we reject this whole tenet that some are saved and some are damned, as our universalist ancestors told us to do, these words can fall away as irrelevant to us, though I might be able to find something of value in the concept of sin and redemption as long as I realize I'm not talking about rigid separations of categories of people, but of problems that we all face as human beings. The challenge in this for me is to not judge those who judge us, to not judge those who judge me. I have known strong evangelical Christians who I have been able to be at peace with because they leave the judging up to their God and accept me where I am. They are in part my models for non-judgmentalism. If I believed what they do, I don't know if I could let others be as they do. I appreciate them for doing so. I strive not to judge their fellow believers who are less agile. I think the phrase church family is another which some UUs find draws lines of who is in and who is out. And on top of that, family is one of those words that carries heavy connotations depending on what kind of experience we've had with our own families. And if those experiences have been negative, we can resist enlarging the idea of family to any group of which we're part. And that's one of those words that begs for the kind of deconcretizing that Laurel Hallman suggests. What if we remade our image of family to be an inclusive group with healthy boundaries and steadfast love? That is the goal of beloved community, which is another phrase that at least one person finds difficult, perhaps because of similar issues as church family. Of course, there can be danger in expecting from church what we expect from family. The standard may be too high. We may be disappointed. We have to remind ourselves that metaphors, and we're talking of metaphors here, that metaphors always fall short, that a church will never really be a family, nor should it be. So we're just streaming through these words here. Benediction is a word that bothers some, perhaps too close to a prayer, reeking of Christian associations. Yet its origin tells us it means speaking well, and one of its definition is an expression of good wishes. The feelings around it likely relate to feelings around blessings generally. How often bless your heart or even bless you feels like a judgment against the person being blessed, like I'll pray for you can be in a particular context. It can be important in these contexts to sort through what the actual meaning is for each person and what connotations are coming from our experience that may not be intended. And while I'm on prayer-related words, there's amen, a habit of mine. I grew up in the South, and while it comes close to a prayer, while it often closes a prayer, yes, it also means yes. As a closing point for something, it was like an exclamation point of affirmation. And in response to an idea, it means ditto, or I agree. And I'm trying to use it carefully rather than in my usual casual way, so please be patient with me. Now, I think I've at least mentioned all the words I elicited from you all, except yoke, which I'm not quite sure what to do with, and covenant, which is a word close to my heart and to our UU heritage and even governance. So that will take a whole lot more explication than I have time for here today. I'll also be keeping in mind these words as we move forward in our work together. And we may revisit different ones as the occasion merits. For now, I'd like to invite you to consider if there are religious words, those mentioned in the sermon today or other words that occur to you, that you would like to spend more time thinking about, exploring. Other words you may just simply wish to set aside and ignore, but maybe there's one word or phrase that invites exploration, either challenging or affirming your own experience. And so what I'd like to do is invite you to take just a few minutes and talk with one or two people around you about those words that you'd like to explore further. So take a couple minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get the mic out and see if we have a larger conversation. Anyone? I said, let's get the mic out and see if we have a larger conversation. Anybody have something to say?
Sacred begins at the tip of your tongue. So, wow, that kind of stopped me in my tracks. I thought, well, at least if I work with that, I can never ever curse. Okay, I can never ever curse something that irritates me. You know, I don't want to put that
energy out. And then I had this revelation the other day, thinking about words. And I realized that the word Indian is exactly the same as the word nigger, in that the intention behind it is to say to people, you do not exist. What we said to the people on this continent was, we want what you have, we'll do anything to get it, and we will never recognize you as a truly human being. So, I've always had trouble with that word, and I know that I'll never use it because the people who were here were Modoc, Powhatan, Iroquois. That word, that other word, the I word really is an ugly fabrication. So this is all religious to me. Thank you.
Sybil Perkins, a word that you used in lead up to asking us to talk about things is the word sermon.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a word that it has powerful negative connotations, and that it applies that someone is going to dispense the truth to the masses. It's more of a top-down sort of thing. I've got the truth. Here it is. And I notice in our program, we call our presentation, or whatever it is we want to call it, it's also called sermon. And that's a word that has negative connotations to me.
I'll have to dig around a little bit with that on where it comes from, its origins, and what, you know, because it doesn't have those connotations to me, but I hear you saying that it does, so I'm going to dig around on that a little.
And in our group, just following up, we were in the same group, we talked about that, how we don't know the origin of it or where it comes from. And how it certainly doesn't mean that top-down communication here. If anything, it's the place where we're really called to attention, where we share, where we are brought to the most interesting things. So we thought maybe we should call it the provocation.
The provocation. Oh, I like that. Provocation.
We didn't, Michael, a little further, we didn't talk about this, but I want to go back to something you said about the need to have dialogues with people who don't, you know, who don't see things quite the way we do, and how to do it. I have to say that I think mostly it's a waste of time, that there's little hope that we will be able to make many people think that if we do not believe as they do, then we can do any damn thing we please because there are no consequences, for instance. So I've had that kind of discussion with people before. But uh, I uh, I will try to do better on this because you've suggested it's a good idea. I don't have a lot of hope because I've watched people's reaction when I've told them I'm an atheist, and it is, well, I think they're nice, but I don't want my children to play with your children, and I don't want to trust you in any way because of that, and I consider it their loss that they don't want to deal with me.
And I think there's certainly some reality to what you say. I mean, I don't know that we're ever going to come to agreement with some of those folks around reality. But there are some of them with whom I wish to maintain a relationship because there is value in having that relationship. And if I can't bring myself fully to that relationship, if I have to stay in denial of what my beliefs are and who I am inside of that relationship, that's hard for me to do. So I want to try to do it. I want to try to bring my full self to that so that when something is said that pushes up against my authentic self, to be able to say, wow, that's something that just doesn't work for me. Could we maybe look at it a different way? So, yeah. Depends on how important the relationship is.
I'm Grace McMillan. I find that being able, well, first, I don't have the baggage of language because I wasn't Christian. Mm-hmm. So, but I did study religions and anthropology, and I find that being able to use this kind of language with believers opens a door to where they can really listen when they find out I'm an atheist, and it just shocks them. And it's almost like I want to dismantle this image that they have through relationship, through words, so that their perception can be changed. And I often hear, like, I just wouldn't have ever thought that you were an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you will be surprised. But it allows you to then have the conversation. Like, there are a lot of people that are afraid to pronounce their, like, own their non-belief in public spaces because it's been so hurtful. Mm-hmm. So I try to actually do it as much as I can.
I wanted to say real quick that I really appreciate this discussion in general, like beyond even like theistic matters. I think it's so important when you're communicating with other people to really define what you're talking about. And how it was really neat that, you know, I was sitting here with, you know, two people that I've known for a long time, and like I learned all sorts of things about them in the minute or two that you gave us to talk, you know, because when you really start digging into meanings of those things. But for me, my word was believe is one that I really struggle with, because I feel like there's this implication that with the absence of belief, you have nothing left but the mundane or the insignificant, I guess. And that's not at all how I feel about the absence of belief in like a faith context. So,
I have heard from two different people in this fellowship in the past that they felt words were hurtful to them when someone here found out they believed in God. And I think we should be careful of that if we're talking about how we express ourselves, or maybe the way we, the attitude in which we do. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm Roger Johnson. Like a Brother Oldfather, I'm an atheist, but I've had a somewhat different reaction. Something specific happened 3 years ago this month that caused me to just proudly proclaim I'm an atheist. And I wrote that on my Facebook personality page, I'm an atheist. I felt very liberated by that. And since then, I felt very liberated you know, using that term and thinking of myself that way. And, well.
And I'd just like to kind of tie some of these comments together a little bit. When that recognition that when I'm speaking for myself, I can claim atheism, I can claim theism, and all of that being okay, that's what the real tension and struggle is. Yeah, being able to hold all of that.
Michaela Sievers, I really have always been an avid reader, and I love language and all of its complexities, because we can definitely choose how we express ourselves and how we communicate with each other, but we have to keep, I think it's important to keep in mind that we won't share the same connotations that other people will, and that's really what this whole discussion is about, and being aware of those connotations. So, you know, Diane, you stood up and talked about how you think that Indian is a horrible word to use. I, from a different generation than pretty much all of you, don't have a negative view of it necessarily, although I do try to say Native American because I feel like it's a, you know, more precise definition, and it doesn't hold some of those connotations. But I never had the notion that Indian was as horrible as you have that connotation of it being. Mm-hmm. But I think that definitely we need to understand that, you know, when I'm talking to someone who has a different perspective, they would use a different vocabulary just because of how they've experienced those words in the past, but the intention behind it is really what we need to be open-minded to, because they're not going to usually be personally attacking us. If they're taking the time to talk to us, hopefully it's a good constructive thing where we can clarify what we mean. So, you know, I just encourage everybody to continue to be the open-minded you use that we are, hopefully, and look beyond the, you know, word and think, well, maybe this is the word they chose, but this probably is what they kind of meant. So, you know, kind of filter that maybe and keep that open-mindedness.
Pat Embers, one of the words that didn't come up this morning was the word spiritual and spirit, which is different. And I've been a member of this fellowship for, 30 years, I guess. And when I first came, I had a different feeling for the word spiritual than I have now, although many of my beliefs are still the same, and I'm not an atheist. And I do lean towards the Native American way of believing, and the word spirit comes out there, comes into that a lot. But it's not just from that. But my feeling about the word spiritual is much more open than it ever would have been if I hadn't been a UU member, I feel, because I'm not sure I can describe any other person's interpretation of that, but I think it's a very significant word, and it means a lot to me, and I think it means a lot to a lot of people in this fellowship in one
way. Yeah, and I said a lot about spiritual last week, so. There's...
My name's Andrew, and it's actually our first time here. And I saw what the topic was today, and I was actually pretty excited. I actually went to a Bible college. I have a bachelor's in missions. So when you said, you know, all these words that you love to hate, good Lord, the list that started in my head. And I think, you know, with our label now we're choosing of atheist, there are a lot of meanings to that word. And being in training to actually be a Bible translator, you learn a lot about the power of words. And one of the things that we came to was this idea that you choose your labels as they help you conceptualize of yourself. And that was something that really allowed us to be more free to choose atheist, if you will, because the way I grew up, atheist was angry, militant. There is no God. There's absolutely no God. You're an idiot for thinking there is. And that's not really how I view it at all. It's more just a, I find there to be a lack of evidence, is all. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're realizing now, because she's in a fantastic class at K-State, is that there's a good chance that it wasn't ever meant to be factual. And that's a very Western modern thing that we've thrust on some of these texts, is that they must necessarily be factually true as we see them. And so I think coming to some of those understandings has helped us a lot. And I hope, you know, that concept of choosing your labels might be beneficial mm-hmm. to other people.
Well, let's let that be the last comment. Let me give you a few words from Vincent Silliman. Let religion be to us life and joy. Let it be a voice of renewing challenge to the best we have and may be. Let it be a call to generous action. Let religion be to us a dissatisfaction with things that are, which bids us serve more eagerly the true and right. Let it be the sorrow that opens for us the way of sympathy, understanding, and service to suffering humanity. Religion uniting us with all that is admirable in human beings everywhere, holding before our eyes a prospect of the better life for humankind, which each may help to make actual. Our closing hymn is number 343, A Fire Mist and a Planet. The 19th century Universalist minister Hosea Ballou proclaimed, "If we agree in love, there's no disagreement that can do us any injury. But if we do not, no other agreement can do us any good. Let us endeavor to keep the unity of the spirit in the bonds of peace. So may it be for us and the extending circles of love and connection that emanate from us."
Amen.